maddening. The road that led us to the height of our involvement seemed to start out as a poorly marked trail with no real starting point. Did it begin with the open door policy at the turn of the century, which Walt Rostow noted last night in his perspective, or with the National Security Council document on Russian containment in 1950 that George Herring told us about? It's not easy, and it's not really known. The question of causality, Professor Herring told us, is infinitely complex. Our involvement in Vietnam fed on itself in a maddening way. Professor Herring said of Vietnam that the more we stressed its importance, the more important it became. Professor Herring reminded us that John Kennedy, when he was a young senator, saw Vietnam as the keystone and the arch, the finger in the dike. Arches and dikes turned into dominoes. In Richard Ellison's film, Jim Thompson of the NSC recounts that President Johnson believed that the final domino is the presidency itself. Johnson was worried about losing the war. What he discovered was that his attempt to win it would send him back to Texas. The war was particularly nettlesome to Johnson's domestic policies, as Liz pointed out. Professor Herring told us that for LBJ, Vietnam was a bitch of a war that kept him away from the great society, the woman he really loved. General Kennard elaborated on these themes in his speech about the post-1965 period. The war, he said, was the greatest failure in foreign policy in our time. In the field, the generals, 70% of whom were uncertain about the objectives of the war, underlined the truth of Clausewitz's assertion, the general turned professor told us, that war can never be separated from political intercourse. Of the United States and the North Vietnamese, General Kennard said, we had the power, they had the will. It seems to me, furthermore, that the war's execution was too cynical to be called mad. The least fuzzy of the military objectives which General Kennard cited for us was the attrit goal. As the general said, a war of attrition is a war of bodies. We were as cynical pulling out, I think, as we were going in. When Richard Nixon decided to Vietnamize the war, according to General Kennard, the people who were running the war in Washington didn't really know whether the Arvin troops could hold up their side of the war as U.S. troops left. General Kennard suggested, I thought, that the people in Washington, furthermore, didn't really care whether the Arvin could or could not hold up its own side. This seems to me to be a cynical abandonment of a people who were fighting at least as much for perceived U.S. interests as for their own. As General Kennard notes, that 1973 to 1975 period has been called the indecent interval. Back home, Harry Wilmer's dreamers were going through their own indecent interval. He told us that 500,000 of the 2.7 million Americans who fought in Vietnam were and are troubled. All of their lives were textured in some way by the war. This would seem to be true to some extent, of course, of all warriors in all wars. But the Vietnam veterans were affected in special ways, and I'd like to touch on one of them because I think it has a bearing on what Robert Bly told us about the break between young men and older men. Every Vietnam veteran we talked to for our Newsweek project came away with a profound lack of respect for authority. Phil Jalan called it this morning irreverence. They felt betrayed by their leaders in Washington. This was true whether they were gung-ho grunts or whether they were survivalists in Vietnam. Nearly every veteran we interviewed told us that he had not voted in a single presidential election and had no plans to do so in the future. It's possible that the sample was not representative, and maybe that's something we could talk about later. Robert Bly has taken this anti-authority figure concept one step further, and his what he said yesterday is intriguing, at least to think about. I haven't, obviously, in my 5-minute speech, covered many of the points that were made this weekend, but judging from this morning's discussion, there were and are a lot of topics, especially those relating to the veterans themselves who were poorly represented, at least on the panel here. And I think that there are a lot of things we still have to talk about. I think we should continue this morning's discussion in a little while and hear more from the audience. But before I close, I wanted to tell you another story. One of the veterans I interviewed was a guy named Don Stagnaro, who now is a narcotics detective in Los Angeles. And he told me a story which seems a fitting way to approach the end of this summary. Don had been back, he was over there in 1968, 1969, and he was a member of Charlie Company. He had been back in the States for several months when he got a letter from an old high school running buddy, David, who was still in Vietnam. David was short. He had only, short as it was used in the vernacular in Vietnam, he had only a few weeks to go on his rotation in Vietnam. And David, like other guys who were short, was afflicted with a kind of superstition, a phobia about imminent death, the notion that something was going to happen before he got out of that place. David felt certain that he was about to die, and he wrote his friend Stagnaro a letter. David asked Stag to write David, company commander. He wanted Stag to persuade the company commander to assign David to the rear for the last few weeks to get him away from the fighting. Stagnaro put a letter together. He had known the company commander, and he had just mailed the letter when one evening the phone rang at his parents' home in San Pedro, California. Stagnaro's mother answered the phone, but as Stagnaro tells the story, he knew instinctively as soon as the phone rang that the call was from David's mother and that she was calling to say that David was dead. And that's what the call was. David had been shot through the head. After a while, David's parents got a little insurance money, and they used it for a down payment on a new house. And in memory of their son, they hung over the front door a sign that read, "The house that David built." And David's parents obviously didn't try to escape the memory of their son's untimely death. They stayed in the house and kept the plaque over the door and walked beneath it every day. It seems to me that America's Vietnam experience is like the house that David built. But as a nation, for most of the time since then, we've tried to leave the house, move out, go somewhere else, suburbs. Only now are we putting up our plaque of sorts, the Vietnam Memorial in Washington. I really don't want to carry this symbolism to extremes, but I think that if we remember Vietnam rather than try to forget it, we will benefit from our experience in the long run. And perhaps it will even help us find, if we want it, that elusive middle ground between what Professor Gaines Post of the University of Texas last night called the Poet's War and the Technician's War. Thank you. Yeah. I think, as I said earlier, I think it would be highly beneficial to just, in effect, take off from this morning's discussion. One of the reservations I have against that is that I did, in fact, do the summary here, and I have characterized only bits and pieces of what other people said, and quite frankly, you may be asking me questions that I can't answer, but maybe the people, a couple of them have left, but most of them are still here. Maybe the speakers, if there's a question that comes up that's relevant to what they said or to what their particular area of expertise is, then that person could get up and answer the question. Yes. Could we have a microphone?
I'm Jim Van Ness. I'm acknowledging fully our obligation to continue or to increase our efforts to work with individuals, men and women, who supported the United States, whether in Vietnam or at home, during that period, and that we had then and still have a problem of veracity in determining the honesty of the policymakers' public statements, and the difficulty of dealing with the ambiguity that surrounded that entire conflict. I'd just like to contrast it to the situation that existed between 1917 and the 1930s. The men who went to war in World War I knew why they were going. They were going for two reasons: to make the world safe for democracy, and to end all future wars. When they came home, not immediately, because they were greeted as heroes and they went back to work, but not long after that, they began to feel, and more extensively, many of those who sent them off began to feel, that they had been lied to, that was not at all what our policy was. I believe that in Mr. Bly's words, President Wilson, Secretary Lansing were liars, in that they conveyed one impression when in fact there was quite another one. Those people went to war for our national self-interest, and they weren't told that. They thought they were on a moral crusade. And the consequences of that was the most extensive, the most deeply felt, most pervasive period of emotional isolationism that has ever existed in this country. It extended all the way through to some of the greatest American historians, who were the most outspoken critics of any involvement in any foreign activity. We had Fortress America. As a result of that, President Roosevelt had to engage in countless actions of impeachable offenses, including the authorization of British terrorists coming into the United States to assassinate German infiltrators during the late 1930s and early 40s. And I think that we have to recognize that, as we have been doing here, that there is a fundamental difference between the public statements of our leaders and the nuances that are behind them. We're much more sophisticated now than we were in 1917. But there is still an information gap, and that's a problem that you particularly have to deal with. And I'm wondering, in part, if there is not, as I perceive it, a much greater understanding of this on the part of the press. At the same time, is there a better understanding of the difficulty that exists in, as Mr. Bly would say, telling the truth?
I think that perhaps there's a better understanding, simply because we're more affected by it. That this is something that Phil talked on briefly this morning. I'm not sure that I entirely get the point of what you're saying. I understand what you're saying, and I think that that obviously there has always been a gap of some sort between what actually was going on and what was perceived to be going on among the people of the country. Perhaps it's become such an important question regarding Vietnam simply because of the way the war turned out. Yes.
Savin, and I'm from Austin, and I wanted to bring up something we discussed at lunch, which has to do with policy making. And this is, it seems that when these men, and I say men because it seems they were predominantly men, gather around the table to make policy, somehow it seems that they take a position of immunity from ethical considerations. And I guess this makes me very angry because I think that during this time, so many of us were trying very carefully to, and are trying to carve a path of integrity in our individual lives, and I think these policymakers are too in their individual lives. And they speak about the Russians or even the Chinese as being the evil. And I guess I'm still somewhat idealistic, but I would like for our country to begin to stand for something and some values and not say that our national interests justify the whatever means, that the end justifies the means, because it really doesn't. And I don't know how our education system, what we can do to ameliorate this situation, that once they get around the table, that these other considerations are impractical, in quotes, because they're very practical. And we need to consider people's lives, and this has been mentioned over and over again. I'm really being redundant, but anyway, it's what has come to me from this conference, and I wish somebody had some ideas about it. Maybe we need more women at these tables.
Probably. Oh, can we have a mic up here?
I'm Paul Woodruff. I'm a veteran. There's something that hasn't been talked about that I think needs to be addressed, and I don't know who here can address it, but it seems to me that we personally and as a country have some kind of responsibility to think about this. And the question is what we should be trying to do for the shattered countries, Vietnam, Cambodia, shattered not just by the Vietnamese takeover, but as the aftermath of 30 years of war, which is, after all, mostly our idea. And what we should be doing about the Indochina refugees, both here, you know, in Texas, in the country, and outside. And whether this, I beginning to, for the first time, to ask as a veteran, whether there's something that veterans in particular have to offer here. This is just a question. I don't have any answer here at all.
I don't either. But your idea, your notion of having veterans work with, in some way, with Indo-Chinese refugees is intriguing. I wonder what Dr. Wilmer would think about. Would that have any kind of therapeutic value?
I think so. I think there are some enormous psychological blocks between the Vietnamese and the veterans, some of them. But that would strike me as a very healing and powerful thing. I would think that could be something along that line could be worked out.
Back in the back row.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bruce Gillick, and I work with the Disabled American Veterans. And one of our major concerns in the DAV right now is veterans' benefits and veterans' legislation. I don't know whether it's economics, office of management, and budget, but and it's a prevailing thing that happens after the war, that the money expended on the military during the war and on the veterans soon after the war, to a certain extent, it kind of blends in, and why is this money being extended? Let's cut back here, let's cut back there. And one of the group of people that have participated in the program today and have given themselves throughout the years now since this Vet Center program has been in operation, fall in purview of the budget cut. They were put on the books or on the rolls to operate for a certain specified time and funded for a specified time. And the question is as to, it gets kind of involved like all of this discussion has indicated, that certain veterans in need of the service of the Vet Center will not, for one reason or another, utilize the VA medical facility, or if they have made choice to go to the VA for one reason or another, that the VA medical facility is not equipped and educated to the extent that they would provide the appropriate services for the veteran with the problems. So I am one who has referred a lot of veterans who come to see me for one reason or another to reopen VA claims, just different things that I make extensive utilization of the services of the two vet centers in San Antonio. And without them, the veteran population in San Antonio would have a difficult problem. In our area, we have 145,000 Vietnam-era veterans living in a county. And out of those, you can presume at least a third of them served in Vietnam. And the type of individual in San Antonio who was drafted and put into the military quite frequently ended up in close combat. And I referred people to Dr. Wilmer, who has aided them immeasurably. And he, in turn, has used the Vet Center extensively. And my concern is, how long will the Vet Center be a viable force to provide their services to the veteran who needs their services? Not only the veteran is serviced by the Vet Center, his wife, his family, and it's done in a situation that's not set up that could be done in the typical clinical situation in a hospital. Some of these veterans have problems that they can't go to the doctor with, they can't discuss with a doctor, can't have written down in medical records that are retrievable. Then they have done things in Vietnam that they can discuss with the people at the Vet Center in special situations that they would never dare discuss with an attending physician unless they had complete trust, which is difficult to do in a typical clinical situation, I think. So it's a very viable role. Plus the wives. VA benefits are entitlements. And if that individual doesn't have a discharge, that's an honorable discharge. That individual has problems, his wife has a problem. It's rare that the wife could go in and get treatment and assistance without even the veteran coming to the facility. The Vet Center provides this. So it's a situation that cost effectiveness, how long are we going to spend this money on this program? When are we going to phase this program into the VA? When will the VA be ready to accept it? When will a veteran be ready to accept the VA? That's one thing. Another issue was brought up this morning by a lady who indicated that she was a female veteran, and she wanted to know when was the VA going to be able to accommodate service to a female veteran. There's many VA hospitals that will not or cannot treat a female. Either they don't want to, or they don't want to spend the extra money it takes to have a system whereby a female can come in and be stored as an inpatient and have the doctors who have the expertise and the background to treat a female. And with the situation in the military services now with a larger female veteran population, that's an issue that needs to be addressed. So I think both of those are important for the people here to consider and think about. Up here.
Thank you. My name's Rod Davis. I'm here as a journalist, but also I was a veteran, and I'm a citizen, and there's some things I like to say, I wanted to address Mr. Jalen specifically, because I didn't get a chance earlier when he was speaking. I'm interested in working on the problems of the veterans and making sure that we don't shift or project our blame as a society onto the veterans and then talk about their problems with drugs, their problems with alcohol, when we're the people that put them there in the first place. And so I keep staring at this statement that was made this morning that Mr. Jalen said that, referring to Vietnam, it wasn't good, neither was it in all regards bad. Ronald Reagan wasn't wrong when he described it as a noble cause. I believe the reference to a noble cause has something to do with allowing South Vietnam to become a self-determined, whatever form of government it chose to have. I think the facts make a complete mockery out of that sort of a statement. But what really bothers me is that seems to imply that if it was sort of a good idea, really, that it was carried out the wrong way. And once again, the veterans take the rap, as in the military, they weren't able to execute this essentially brilliant idea that the best and the brightest thought up. And I take a certain amount of offense at this kind of a patronizing, and I may be wrong, but I wish, if Mr. Jalen wants to speak to it or if someone else would like to speak to this issue, I appreciate it.
I'd be glad to speak to it, because the last thing in the world I was trying to convey was that the veterans should take the rap. On the contrary, the veterans least of all should take any rap. And responding to your question, what can veterans contribute? I think veterans have more to contribute in terms of those who have participated in this venture than anybody. They have the best record. The rest of us, the press, the government, the military, the civilian leadership, the Congress, all failed in serious ways. It is the veterans alone who did not fail. And you ought to recognize that. You ought to recognize that you can speak on this war with greater authority. You have a greater claim to public attention than anybody involved in it. I was disturbed this morning when somebody said that they were too bad that the veterans had to initiate the memorial. That's the best part of it. That's what came out of this war. It was the veterans' discovery of brotherhood, of the brotherhood of Vietnam.
This discussion continues on code 9B-48-82.